This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is 5live and we're being live streamed, which is a very nice thing.
I am assured by David, who works on this programme, that when Jason Isaacs is said hello to, where'er he be,
yes,
and whether he is dressed as an 18th century Spaniard or whatever it is, he says hello back.
To the ether.
I know, but now knowing that, I think that it means that we need to leave a little gap after saying hello to him, like they used to do on on television. Well, like they still do on CBeebies.
Hello there.
Hello, Jason.
That's good. I think we do that. And for Dave Morrissey. So, hello, Jason. And hello, David. And I don't think Ken Branagh does get on, because Ken Branagh needs to come in and have a conversation before we allow him in.
Okay. The gauntlet is thrown down then. If he would come in and have a conversation, then he can be on the list.
We can say hello. I think we say hello to members of Fairport Convention, all of them. Whoever are listening, and assorted members of Pentangle if they want to join in.
Yes.
And Focus.
I'm not sure about Focus, but Pentangle definitely.
Tees Van Leer, I'm sure, is listening somewhere.
Really? Isn't that something you put on a
Jan Ackerman is the only other one I can remember.
No.
Yeah, I can remember half of Focus. That's desperate.
Yeah, no, I can't remember Focus at all.
mayo@bbc.co.uk. You can text us 85058. Movies top 10 coming up in just a moment. Reviews of Fred Claus. I can't wait. Hitman, The Assassination of Jesse James, which is half the title.
Yes, it is.
The Magic Flute, which is Ken's.
Yes.
We might not get that far, to be perfectly honest. Now, we just need to tell you about some Christmas movie conversation. It's going to be a bit of an online special.
Okay.
We're going to try and find what people consider to be the very finest movie about Christmas, related to the festive period in some way.
Christmas movie,
yeah,
in the broadest sense.
That's right. And you've come up with 10.
I just came up with 10 that I thought were, you know, were good starting points.
This is going to be an online vote from 4 o'clock. However, we'll just want to go through this 10 quite quickly.
Yes.
And we only want to have 10 to go through to the final vote. But if people disagree, or if they want to put in a choice of their own, they have to tell us why.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to be prepared, get this, to be flexible and admit that maybe one of your choices will be replaced.
No, I'm very happy to be flexible, because that list is literally a kind of starting point list, and I'm sure there are. That's fine.
So, according to Mark, these are the finest Christmas movies ever.
In chronological order.
It's a Wonderful Life,
yep.
1946. Miracle on 34th Street, 1947. A Christmas Carol, 1951. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, 1964.
Which is also called Santa Claus Versus the Martians. So
Black Christmas, 1974. Gremlins, 1984. It happens at sort of around Christmas time, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, it's, you know, people getting stuck down chimneys is very Santa Clausy.
Brazil, 1985.
Yep.
Die Hard, 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Scrooged, also 1988, clearly a golden year.
Yes.
And The Nightmare Before Christmas from 1993. That would be Mark's tentative suggestion for the 10 finest Christmas movies. If you'd like to suggest that maybe you have something better and why, you have to let us know while we're on before 4 o'clock. Then the voting starts at 4 o'clock.
And I'd say already that I'm already warming towards The Muppet Christmas Carol, which was number 11, and I really wanted to get it in, but we had to get it down to 10, and I'm already starting to regret the absence of it.
So which is most vulnerable, do you think, from that list?
Of all of that lot?
Yeah.
Maybe the... Well, no, you see... No, I'm not going to say, because then it'll fall off the list and I don't want it to.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk, this week's top 10 in this order. Number 10, 30 Days of Night.
On its way out of the top 10, but I'm turning to Alan Freeman. Fluff's on its way out, boys, you pop pickers. No, but I like it. It's not a brilliant movie, but it's a good, solid horror romp by the guy who made Hard Candy. Incidentally, the woman who stars in Hard Candy, Ellen Page, has got a new film coming out called Juno, which she is just great in.
She was great when she sang Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. She had a fantastic range.
That's right. That was her lesser-known sister, Elaine. Well done. And she'll have to live with that for the rest of her life. But Juno, she's really good in.
Elizabeth, the Golden Age.
Or Elizabeth, the We Made It Up Age. Pirates of the Caribbean versus the Spanish. And total nonsense, but not without a certain degree of fun. As many people have pointed out, biggest problem with it is Mary Queen of Scots speaking in a Scottish accent, in that she wasn't, or didn't.
Shrooms.
Yeah, you know, a bunch of, it's an Irish movie about a bunch of teenagers take a bunch of magic mushrooms and death ensues. It's one of those things, if you can't see the twist coming from a very, very long way away, then you've probably been ingesting as well. It's a shame, because it's so much not a movie that makes the best of its culture. It's a movie that attempts to sort of sell transatlantically. And it's not terrible, but it's just join the dots horror stuff.
August Rush
is
number 7.
Awful. It's awful. I mean, it's really, really gut-bustingly awful. And it, the thing about it is, the worst crime of it is, it's a movie about music, about the transcendent power of music, that appears to be made by people who have never seen a musical instrument in their life. It's one of those things where hands on the keyboard, hands go up the keyboard, sound of notes go down the keyboard. You know, person grabs a stringed instrument as if being given a knitting loom and then proceeds to strike it about with a bow in a manner which can only be described as... I mean, I don't mind any of this stuff, but just for heaven's sake, if you're going to play a musical instrument on screen, I know you don't have to be able to play the musical instrument, although, of course, that's what Jeffrey Rush did in Shine, didn't it? Jeffrey Rush hands doubled by Jeffrey Rush. Good for him.
Well,
for heaven's sake...
The Rack 3.
Yeah, the Rack 3.
Very
the most,
difficult.
The most dangerous of all pieces of music. I mean, E minor, which I've often thought to be the saddest of all keys. Name that film.
The what?
This is Spinal Tap. Anyway, August Rush is horrible. Horrible film. It's a shame, but it's horrible.
Excuse me, the Darjeeling Limited at number 6.
Smug. And again, you know, Wes Anderson, I really like The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and I thought it was, you know, funny and quirky. And but there's a very thin line between quirky and irksome. And in this case, the problem with it is, it's a bunch of people going across India, and the gag is, it's the way in which Americans go across India and they discover spiritual truths. But the movie actually does think that it ends up discovering spiritual truths, and it sort of gets sucked into the very thing that it's satirising, and it's just very pleased with itself.
Everyone's favourite Good Luck Chuck at number 5.
Just gruesome, horrible, nasty piece of work. I mean, really, I think that the clearest indication of how bad it is that there is a long sequence at the end that involves the lead actor in a comic situation with a stuffed penguin. And it goes on and on and on. And I don't believe in the concept of obscenity. But there are some things which I think in the Greek meaning of the word should genuinely be kept off stage.
And what is the Greek meaning of the word?
Off stage.
Oh, right.
Which is why I said
so
the Greek meaning
means off stage.
Off stage.
Is that the Greek?
It is from the Greek,
and
yes.
Does it mean off stage?
It does, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of obscenity, is that which shall not be shown. And in the case of the end of Good Luck
Chuck,
you don't
believe in that.
I don't, in general, in a legal term or illegal, but I do believe absolutely that the end, or in fact the whole of Good Luck Chuck, is that which should not be shown.
So in the Greek...
It's obscene.
Ratatouille at 4.
I mean...
Stardust at 3.
The short for Ratatouille is very funny, though. The short at the beginning, the taken short, which somebody wrote in and said at the end, the guy gets crushed, but he doesn't.
Beowulf at 2.
Oh, we're just moving straight on. Okay, I am Beowulf. I am Ray Winston. It's 3D. It throws everything in the kitchen sink at your face. The 3D technology is quite good. Can I just also take this opportunity to say briefly, I do not believe that by 2009, 1 in 4 mainstream movies are going to be 3D, despite the massive investment that the studios are now making in digital 3D screens. But all the people who are like the people behind Avatar, the people behind the Monsters movie, the Disney Monsters thing, which is not called Monsters, it's called something else.
Monsters, Inc.
No, it's not called Monsters, it's called something else.
In the Greek?
Offstage. But we are all being told that actually flat screen cinema as we know it, dead. 3D cinema with synthespians is the future. And let me be the first to say, I don't believe it.
Number 1 this week is American Gangster,
which I like very much. It's a real return to form for Ridley Scott. He had a very bad time with A Good Year, which was, you know, which he demonstrated that the one thing he really can't do is light comedy. But what he can do is very stylish evocations of a world. This is very post-French Connection. It's a very hard act to follow the French Connection, but it does pretty well. And best of all, Russell Crowe, who can be a really narcissistic performer, actually comes on as schlubby and difficult and downbeat, although of course he's not Gene Hackman, but then who is other than Gene Hackman?
I can't speak.
What have you lost?
I've lost my pen and I can't speak.
No, here's a pen.
Oh, there you go.
But this is funny because you and I are exactly the same. I don't write anything, but I have to hold a pen. Otherwise, I can't do this.
I don't know why. The saddest key is D minor. Why is Brazil a Christmas
movie? What do you mean the saddest key is D minor?
That's officially right in Spinal Tap.
Is it D minor?
Yes.
It's E minor, isn't it?
Trust me.
It's a championship between Mozart and Bach.
Brazil a Christmas movie?
Because it's set at Christmas.
Apart
have you seen
that,
Brazil?
In the Greek. A long time.
No. Okay, fine. Let me do this very quickly because it's very important.
You're not going to act any of it out.
No. The Christmas thing about Brazil is very, very important. At the very beginning, right, when the army come down, the kids are sitting around waiting. Said, "How is Father Christmas going to get into our house? We haven't got a chimney." You hear chink, chink. Then bang, the army come through the ceiling and they hijack the guy. They take off the guy. At the very, very end, it ends up with the characters all dressed up as Father Christmas. When he looks in and says, "Oh, you know," the finishing line is, "It's a Christmas movie." That is a very very profound Christmas movie.
I wasn't doubting it. I was just asking why. That's all.
I mean, you sort of asked in a slightly aggressive way.
I just couldn't remember.
All right. D minor.
I wasn't aggressive. D minor is correct.
No, it is. Just lift it up. It is, it's D minor.
Sophie Benzing joins in, and it also was There's a Hole in My Bucket, Dear Liza, and not Elijah.
I just heard a voice in my head as well from the control saying, it's D minor. I know, because he's telling me.
The other members of Focus, of course, as well as Jan Ackerman and Thijs van Leer, were, as everyone now realises, Pierre van der Linden on drums and Bert Reiter on bass.
And Johnny Van Warmer.
And apparently, according to Oliver, as a resident of Southampton, Mark will be delighted to hear that Focus regularly play at the Brook, merely yards from the Talking Heads, where Mark's own band plays.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have no excuse. If you're sending in better and different Christmas movies, you have to include a reason, because if Mark's going to knock one of his 10 out, you have to have the power of persuasion. Include that, please. And Stu on this text, thank you, Simon. I haven't been able to do any work since 2 o'clock because your guests have been so entertaining. Now that Mark's on, Vassos, thanks very much. It's 3:36. This is 5 Live, talking movies up until 4 o'clock. We've already said hello to the assorted members of Pentangle, Fairport Convention, Dave Morrissey, Jason Isaac. So we're clear for business. What's up first?
The assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, which, as its
title
suggests,
and the plot.
Yes, it is about the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Brad Pitt is Jesse James in the sort of in the latter period of his life, when he's gone from being the kind of the gunslinging outlaw who gets away with anything to being the gunslinging outlaw who's a kind of borderline psychopath who happens to have a wife and kids but is largely psychopathic, but is more importantly looking every day more and more like he is embracing death. Along comes Casey Affleck as the coward Robert Ford, who, as we know from the outset, I mean, it's one of those things in which the title tells you the plot, even if you didn't
and
know
the
plot beforehand. And the end. No, but of course, it's crucially, that's not actually the ending. What you know is that this one character is going to kill the other character, and that's what it's about. So it's never, there's never any ambiguity about that at all. But it is about the idea of approaching death. But it is also, I think importantly, about the idea that the character who is going to kill Jesse James is, in a very modern, celebrity-conscious kind of way, obsessed by him.
If you'll pardon my saying so, I guess it is interesting the many ways you and I overlap and whatnot. I mean, you begin with our daddies. Your daddy was a pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church, and my daddy was a pastor of the church in Excelsior Springs. You're the youngest of 3 James boys, and I'm the youngest of 5 Ford boys. Between Charlie and me is another brother, Wilbur here, with 6 letters in his name. And between Frank and you is another brother, Robert, also with 6 letters. And my Christian name is Robert, of course. You have blue eyes, I have blue eyes. You're 5'8" tall, I'm 5'8" tall. Must have had a list as long as your nightshirt when I was 12, but I seem to have lost some curiosities over the years.
So the entire movie is framed in this way, that you have this one character who's slightly pitiful, slightly sort of weedy, and who lives completely in love with the myth of Jesse James. And it is the myth of Jesse James. And this, we know from the beginning, is the person who will bring about his outset. So there are many things that this chimes with. One of them, of course, is that there is a slightly biblical thing to do with Judas. There is also, I think, hints, for example, of Mark Chapman, of the killing of John Lennon, you know, to do with you're obsessed with the celebrity, and that becomes, you know, absolutely lethal. And it's also about the way in which the myth implodes upon itself, that the character who is going to die brings about their own death. They understand that what they're in is a kind of end game, that they, what they're doing is they're doing the dance of death. It's, to some extent, there's a bit of the seventh seal, which is a dancing circus movie involving rubber balls, not that one. Now, the interesting thing about this is that both the things I've said about it and the title make it sound terribly portentous and terribly ponderous. In fact, there was a column in one of the newspapers today saying, you know, any movie with a title like that has to be a ponderous pain. I sat there, I went into it knowing that it was 160 minutes long, which is a languorous walk of a movie, and also knowing that it had this very, very portentous title, and going in expecting very little. I came out, and I went to see it with a colleague of mine, and I came out, and we both walked out, and we both looked at each other and went, is it just me, or is that perhaps the best movie you've seen this year? It was reminiscent of Terrence Malick in the best possible sense. Whenever anybody says something's reminiscent of Terrence Malick, it usually means that what you get is lots lots of long tracking shots and lots of sort of grassy idylls, and it doesn't really have substance because it's very hard to live up to Terrence Malick. But this is like what Terrence Malick was like before he lost the plot and made The New World and just, you know, retold the Pocahontas story in totally messy fashion. It has some very fine performances. Brad Pitt is pretty good. Casey Affleck in many ways steals the movie out from under his nose because he plays the coward and he does it brilliantly. And the temptation with the sort of the revisionist westerns that we're getting now is always, if it's 160 minutes and it's about death, is to say, well, it's elegiac. Of course, the thing with this is it's not elegiac. It is, and this sounds terribly pretentious, but I mean it. It is existential. It is about dying, and it is about death, and it is about the myth outliving the character. And amazingly, for a film in which fundamentally you know the key thing that's happening, you know what's going to happen. The guy's going to meet. He's going to kill him. Everyone knows that story. It's a very, very famous. It's such a famous story, of course. It's in the song, you know, the Ballad of Jesse James, and mm-hmm. Which famously has the line about poor Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life, three children. They were brave. And at one point, one of the guys, well, he didn't. He had two children. But it's about the sort of the creeping cult of celebrity. It's a character study in people falling apart. It's very, I mean, it's a kind of True Grit, earthy Western. It's beautifully shot. Cinematographically, it's awesome to look at. And you really don't feel that length. I didn't want it to be any longer. And apparently there was a longer first cut. Apparently there was a 3.5 hour first cut, of which this is, a cut back version. Well, I tell you, whoever it was that edited it down to this version got it exactly right. This is the length it needs to be. I don't want to see a director's cut on DVD. I don't want to see missing scenes. I don't want to see outtakes. This is how the film should be. And you know my reservations about Brad Pitt. And you know my reservations. This directed by Andrew Dominik. The thing he directed before was Chopper, which is, again, this may be the link, a portrait of a psychopath, a real life psychopath, somebody who was in prison and was, by his own admission, a very, very nasty piece of work. But kind of, it was a kind of lovable, normal guy who just liked a bit of violence. Well, funnily enough, that's sort of what, and of course Chopper was Antipodean Welsh, thank you, but he was played by Sir Anthony Hopkins. And in many ways, that does chime with the Jesse James character, but the centre of attention here is the coward Robert Ford. Of course, that title is meant ironically. It's all about what it means to be a coward. In these terms, it's the mythical terms. And I don't want to overstate this, but it's really good. And I'm going to go and see it again now because I was so surprised at how good it was. I kind of stumbled out into the light and went, blimey, well, I didn't see that coming at all. There is an outside possibility that on the second run, it may not be quite as shimmering, although the colleague that I went to see it with, Nigel, my very good friend, saw it again a couple of days later, and we spoke after. I said, is it still as good? He went, it's every bit as good. It's really something, and it's currently vying with things like This Is England for my best of the year list.
I think people might be surprised about, because exactly as you say, people have taken against it because of the titles. Some reviewers have been particularly sniffy, and you get the sense they took against it right from the word go, just because they've looked at that.
Because of the title, because it does sound pompous. It sounds pompous and pretentious, but it's like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I never thought I'd love a film like that, and of course I think that was actually one of the best, if not the best film of that year. But believe me, if this is a proper grown-up story, not elegiac, existential. It's got heart, it's got soul, it's got something that kind of hints at a world beyond this in its mythological terms. It's really good.
I've always said elegiac, but I don't think I've read it as elegiac, and now realise that maybe I've been saying it wrong.
It's apparently I'm right, and E minor is the saddest of all keys.
That'll be the first thing you've got right for quite a while.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan in Nottingham.
You're slightly stunned that I've just been that nice about it, aren't you? You're slightly blank on me now.
There's a long time to go.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
Jonathan in Nottingham. Mark has forgotten Home Alone. We were talking about Christmas.
No, I didn't forget it. I left it out.
How could he? It's the finest
Chris Columbus.
And funniest slapstick produced since Laurel and Hardy.
Chris Columbus. I'm not having him in the list.
Well, you can't just say Chris Columbus and therefore.
I can. I just did. Chris Columbus.
Yeah, but it's, as arguments go, it's poor. What about a comment? Jonathan has sent us a text. He deserves slightly more than that.
He doesn't, though.
Okay. Well argued. Stephen Lanark, may I nominate The Apartment? Not only the best Christmas movie, but the best movie ever made. Schnook Underdog gets the present he always wanted. Pathos, I haven't seen it.
You just say work out what's the final line of The Apartment Song?
Pathos, I just told you, I haven't seen it.
No, but you must know it. It's like you don't have to have seen Casablanca to know.
Pathos,
you know.
Genuine laughs, timeless quotable dialogue, and Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon at the height of their powers.
Oh. I have a real thing for Shirley MacLaine. I met Shirley MacLaine a few years ago when she was in her dotage, as she still is, and she's incredibly charismatic. Last line of The Apartment, Shut Up and Deal, which is generally regarded as the best last line of a movie, along with Nobody's Perfect. And this is the beginning of A Beautiful Friendship.
Could this argue its way in?
I think that could do. Funnily enough, I wasn't thinking of it as a Christmas movie, but that is a possibility.
John in Barcelona. How about Poltergeist?
It's got a lot. Well, I've got Gremlins, you see, and I don't really think of Poltergeist as a Christmas film. I suppose, is it a Christmas film? Does it happen at Christmas, Poltergeist?
Chris says, The Muppet Christmas Carol is the best Christmas film ever because it's a traditional, funny, happy film and appeals to people of all ages on all levels. It's a classic, brightens up every Christmas.
Actually, I think that's the one that's going to go in, actually.
It's the one that you put on and you think, this is just going to be for the kids. And actually, it is laugh out loud in the first couple of minutes.
And it is very true to the source. I mean, it is the spirit of it is exactly right.
You can vote on these Christmas best movies online from 4. We're just trying to work out whether any gets knocked out of Mark's 10. Nick in Belfast, obviously a glaring omission, is Digby, The Biggest Dog in the World, a film that was shown at Christmas every year during the 70s and early 80s when I was a kid. Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without a film about an animal in peril and Jim Dale. My vote goes
to insert gag of your choice here.
My vote goes to Gremlins, says Nick. Roger in Angmering, I agree with It's a Wonderful Life, but number 2 should be National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
No, I wasn't going anywhere near that. I hate that film.
Simon and the Good Doctor, Scrooge 1951, how can you not pick that? Alistair Sim, who is always good, is brilliant in this film. He was made for the role and it's better than Scrooged. You just have to decide if any of these get in. Dave in Jarrow, Planes, Trains and Automobiles. Why? To remind us that Steve Martin actually used to be funny, and it's D minor that's the saddest of all the keys. The reason that doesn't get in, it's a Thanksgiving film.
Oh, right.
It's not Christmas.
That's a technicality, though, isn't it? Because in America...
No, it's not about
Christmas. No, it's a different festival, I understand.
Yes,
but I think
November.
Yeah, Home for the Holidays, though, isn't that a Thanksgiving movie, but you think of it as being a Christmas movie? Because what happens is the Thanksgiving movies in America get released here at Christmas.
Peter on this says, afternoon, gents, Muppet Christmas Carol is great. I'd like to nominate City of Lost Children for its gorgeously creepy Christmas sequences. Multiple Santas plopping down the chimney and the worst Santa in the world ever. Did Bad Santa make the list? Also,
I hate Bad Santa.
Oh, that's
not funny. Doctor Who, of course. We haven't got the Doctor Who Father Christmas episode, which my little boy absolutely loves.
And Damien on this says Trading Places, Eddie Murphy being funny for once, Dan Aykroyd getting punished, Denham Elliott as a butler, Jamie Lee Curtis as a hooker, top draw. Any of those replace any of your 10?
I think it's going to be Muppet Christmas Carol is the one that's going to come in, because that's the one I really regret.
To knock out?
Well, have you got a Christmas Carol in 51? You can put it in there somewhere. Put it in there.
Okay, so Carol 51.
Yep.
And we put Muppet Christmas Carol. You can vote online from 4 o'clock. Shirley MacLaine on this programme, December the 10th.
No! Okay, I have to tell you this now. I have to say, you have to ask. Shirley MacLaine was the inspiration for the Chris McNeil character in The Exorcist. She was Bill Blatty's next door neighbour.
Why don't you come in and bore her with that?
Ask her who the picture on the front cover of the novel of The Exorcist is, and she will tell you it's her daughter.
That'll be something to look forward to.
It will.
Why don't you come in and do it?
Happily.
Hey,
happily.
Review, let's do a couple of movies.
Let's do the 2 Christmas movies and get them out of the way, which is This Christmas and Fred Claus. So This Christmas is just like typical dysfunctional family has to get back together again for Christmas. So Loretta Devine is Medea, that's her name, and she's the matriarch to whom all the people come back. We have a son who's got a career, he wants to be a singer, but he can't tell her about it because her husband was a musician and he left because of that. You've got a musician who's got some guys on his tail because he owes him some money. You've got a daughter who's got a husband who's cheating on her and she's obviously got to get rid of the husband. All this stuff happens. It's very boring, very sort of, you know, bland, innocuous and pretty tedious. And then at the end there is a 4-minute dancing sequence. I hate funny dancing sequences in which the cast dance in a funny way because dancing is inherently funny. I mean, look, for example, at Evan Almighty. When everything else is failing, they do the dance. God actually says to Evan, you know, hey, do the dance, and he does the dance. And at the end, the whole of the end credit sequence is all the cast and crew doing the dance. And it wasn't funny the first time. And during the end credit sequence, it's just absolutely grisly. And in This Christmas, literally, it goes on for 4 minutes before the credits roll. And it's an indication of how badly things have gone wrong that they think that they have the right to end with 4 minutes of us watching them dancing. More importantly, they do dancing out of character. So characters who in the movie are brothers and sisters suddenly start dancing lecherously with each other in a completely weird and totally non-festive and, you know, I think largely illegal outside of some European states, countries, you know, way. It's totally inappropriate.
Which European countries would they be?
Well, isn't there somewhere where you're allowed to marry your third cousin or something?
You said sister.
No, they are sisters. There must be somewhere. I mean, I know, you know, generally I'm against it. You know, really?
You reckon?
Yeah, I am.
Unbalanced.
So, movie, I'm just...
You're such a moralist.
Taking into account the broad sweep of opinion across the European frontiers, I'm not for that. Anyway, so bad
so your moral compass in general says... Don't marry your cousin.
Don't marry within your family, yes. Okay. And it's the thing about, you know, if you go to any place in which they say, this is my wife and my sister, and then you have one person in the room, leave now. However, in comparison with Fred Claus, it's a masterpiece. I mean, it's a grisly, stupid, toshy movie, but then along comes Fred Claus, Vince Vaughn, directed by the guy, I think it's the same guy who directed Vince Vaughn in The Wedding Crashers, which I never thought was funny in the first place. The story is, get this, right? Saint Nick had a lesser-known brother, Fred, right? Now...
Funny already.
They have to explain this at the beginning. Whenever anyone is made a saint, they automatically become immortal, as do the whole of their family. Well, I thought
you're
the sanctification...
Dead.
Exactly! From the beginning, for opening reel, anyone who did Theology 101 is going, sorry, nope, you're a stiff. It's not going to happen. It's not that your family are living forever, it's that you're all pushing up the daisies. But no, in this particular case, they can all live forever. Cut to modern day, Fred Claus living in New York. Chicago, some faceless city. Nobody says... Interestingly enough, he hasn't aged in hundreds and hundreds of years. Nobody points out that he is basically a vampire. Nobody points out this is a horror movie waiting to happen. So Fred Claus, downtrodden brother, needs to borrow some money. So rings up his brother, Father Christmas, who can lend him some cash. Father Christmas has money? When did that happen? Father Christmas isn't in the monetary system. Father Christmas is Father Christmas. Anyway, so he then goes to the North Pole and learns through the wonder of the movie the magic of Christmas. Now bear in mind, this is Vince Vaughn, who really should know better, learning about the majesty of Christmas in Fred Claus.
Look, guys, we gotta make as many presents as we can in the next 10 hours.
Fred, it's Christmas Eve. It's impossible. We just can't build that many toys in that time.
The rule says that every kid gets a toy. So what would be the easiest toy to make? One for boys and one for girls.
A baseball bat.
A hula hoop.
Well, baseball bats and hula hoops it is then. Charlene, do you think it's possible we can make enough gifts to meet our quota?
It is, but Fred, that's not what the kids asked for.
Yeah, but all that matters is that each of the kids get a toy. That they all have something that they can open when they wake up in the morning. Most importantly, that they all know that there's somebody out there who's thinking about them. You guys have never missed a Christmas before. If you guys are going to go out this year, you're going to go out trying.
I mean, honestly, it was all you could do to stop sicking in the aisles. And you think this is disgraceful. How dare he? I mean,
is
how...
Is it obscene?
Pardon me?
Is it obscene in the original Greek sense?
In the original Greek sense, it really is. It's just absolutely... Well, a number of things are grotesque about it. Firstly, it exists in that horrible Hollywood version of, you know, of the Christmas town, which everything looks like the set of Scanners. It's really plastic and weird and creepy and freaky and strange and not nice. And Dudley Moore in Santa Claus, the movie, has got a lot to answer for, because ever since that film... Remember the tagline, You Believe a Man Can Fly, which was like a postmodern gag about Superman. And then we had... The Santa Claus with Tim Allen. Then we had, you know, I mean, it's really this whole new Jingle All the Way, these kind of, you know, postmodern Christmas movies. Hey, you know, we can all enjoy them together because the kids can see the mythology and the parents can wink, you know, at the Vince Vaughn jokes. It's just grotesque. Now, the other thing that I have a problem, badly written, badly acted, badly directed, really sicky and horrible and nasty, and does demonstrate that probably Christmas has been overtaken by Satan. And, you know, and he and his minions are slowly planning an attack on all Western culture, and we are going to drop down into the bowels of Hades because of films like
true?
This. Yes, that is true.
That's really,
the other
really
thing,
true.
The other thing that I have a problem with is...
Is that breaking news, by the way?
What, breaking
Satan
news? That we are,
taken,
Satan has taken over Christmas. We're all going to hell in a handcart.
Okay.
Hell in a handcart was the woman who married Tim Burton. There is another problem with it, and I'd be interested to know what people's response are to this. This may be just me. There are many people in the film who are... little people. This apparently being the you know the correct term, okay?
And not dwarf.
No, but there are reasons why people don't like that word, okay? Which is perfectly fine, okay? And I'm speaking. Apparently, the preferred term, particularly in America, is little people. Fine, okay? Many of them playing Santa's little helpers. This is very difficult because if you are a little person actor, you know you do end up playing Santa's little helpers, which is a pain. Now that's difficult enough. But the thing I have a real problem with is something which started with Little Man is getting a little person actor and superimposing onto them the head of a large person, you know, to pretend to be a little person. Look, there are loads and loads of actors who are little people out there in the world, and many of them are really good, and many of them are really funny, and many of them are really talented. And forgive me, but isn't it like blacking up? Isn't it something that we just wouldn't think of doing anymore? Isn't it insulting? Isn't it insulting to take a little bit and to superimpose somebody else's head on them as if you're saying, I can't find an actor who is a little person to do this role? Now, listen, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is a very, very bad thing. I just think it's terribly, you know, mean and stupid.
You finished?
Yeah.
Magic Flute and Hitman, please, okay, before 4 o'clock.
Very, very quickly. Magic Flute, which I like very much. Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of Mozart. Should we play a little bit under me while I'm doing this? Because it's the music. Do you want to start running a little bit of the clip?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Mozart's Magic Flute, okay? The plot of Magic Flute is completely bonkers, but it's light and dark, you know, good and evil and all that stuff. And Kenneth Branagh really got himself kicked around town for Sleuth, which nobody liked very much. I have to say, I wasn't a huge fan of it, although I think it did fail interestingly.
What's happening at this point?
Okay, battlefield, trenches, man fighting for his life. Along comes huge big tank with large woman dressed in leather. On a, you know, like that. You see, he's turned into Ken Russell. It's absolutely brilliant. Originally he was the new Olivier. Now he's become the new Ken Russell. Loads of CGI visuals, libretto by Stephen Fry, so you can actually understand, you know, what's going on. Very, very simple, straightforward, populist way of doing it. And what they've done is they've grabbed the text by the throat, they've thrust it into the audience's face, they've said, let's have fun with this, let's make it a cinematic experience, let's not be stuffy and reverential, let's do it really properly and well. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I don't know anything about opera whatsoever. Now, apparently some people who are opera buffs have become quite agitated by this and said, oh, it's not right. That's not how it's meant to be. You know, I mean, honestly, if you carry on like that, you'll have ordinary people understanding it. But it reminded me of, you know, Amadeus, your favourite film.
Yep.
You know, the scene in Amadeus when they're on stage doing that huge, great big production of the opera with things crashing in. It's like that, but on screen with CGI and mad visuals, and it's really good fun. Hitman, finally.
Hitman in 40 seconds.
Yet another demonstration that there is no such thing as a good film based on a video game. So here we go. Super Mario Brothers, Street Fighter, Doom, Tomb Raider, Silent Hill. Now this all rubbish story is bald guy with gun and tattoo on the back of his head has to run around being a hitman and jumping out of some windows. It's lecherous and leery in its treatment of women. It is totally non-narrative. It's rather like watching somebody else playing a video game and apparently playing it rather badly. Timothy Oliphant plays the lead character, which was in a role that was originally intended for Vin Diesel, and boy, do you really miss Vin Diesel, because Vin Diesel looks good with a shaven head. Timothy Oliphant looks like, what are the scores, George Dawes?
Oh, if you miss Vin Diesel, that's something. The vote for the Christmas movies takes place in about 20 seconds' time online. However, your movie of the week?
Well, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Thank you. You can take part online now.
Thank you.
Mail at bbc.co.uk is our email. bbc.co.uk/5live is where you can go. Have a fantastic weekend.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.